Welcome to the Supertrain Podcast. My name is Richard Guerin. Today I'm sitting down with composer Cliff Eidelman. Cliff's a well-known composer of things like Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. He's done a lot of other big film score things, but he and I connected a number of years ago over the phone, and over the years we had a chance to get together at his home in LA and meet in New York, and always it's a real treat. We sit down and talk about music, and somewhere along the line Cliff shared this idea that he someday wished to write a symphony. Flash forward many years, he has written a symphony called Symphony for Orchestra and Two Pianos, which he recorded at Abbey Road Studios in London with no less than the London Symphony Orchestra. Also included on this album is a chamber orchestra piece that he wrote called Night in the Gallery, which was inspired by famous works of visual art. Cliff is a really great guy. It took me a while to put this one together. This conversation's actually from a couple of months ago, but the music and the man himself are timeless, so I hope you enjoy. These two new pieces, and with that I welcome Cliff Eidelman.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Well, actually I'm not doing too good. I'm here 3,000 miles away from you in Salem, Massachusetts, and it's we're anticipating 6 to 10 inches of snow, and wow. I'm thinking of you in sunny California.
Well, you know, the surf is up today, and yes. The sun is out, and everyone's at the beach.
Oh, great. Good for you. Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, I joke about it, but I actually think about this quite often. In writing the symphony, you talked a lot about the image and images of water and the movement of water and sort of crystal clear streams and things like that. And whenever I go to California, I can't the geography is just so dramatic and over what we don't have sort of big mountains, and you know, you can see snow-covered mountains from LA County, and you have all of these natural splendors, which is quite different from where I am. To what degree do you think California itself, as your artistic home and where I think you've spent most of your, if not all of your life, to what degree has California made it into your music, do you think?
I think it made it into some degree, probably more unconsciously into the symphony than literally, because I really wasn't thinking too much continually about particular landscapes around here. But instead, I think I really was sort of imagining just all these grand bodies of water, from the oceans to the streams to lakes to the tension in our time with climate and other things that just kind of all found itself sort of swirling in my mind. But having said that, living 19 blocks from the ocean, I'm sure draped itself over me in some way or another and created some kind of effect on me. It's kind of unreal in that I've done quite a few projects in film that dealt with the ocean in different ways. I'm not exactly sure why that seems to be coming towards me all the time, but I do like it, and I like writing in that style.
Well, when you did films like whether it be Christopher Columbus or Big Miracle, did you have those same same inspirations? I mean, were you thinking about water as a character in those films?
They were part of it for sure, especially in well, in both of those. I mean, when I'm thinking about all the different films I've done that dealt with water and the ocean, there was Big Miracle is more recent. I did a IMAX film called Ocean Men. And then I actually very recently this year did a kind of an aquarium sort of piece, a 10-minute piece called Being Dolphin. Christopher Columbus was quite a while ago, but it definitely was more about characters than it was the ocean itself. It was more about just the discovery of America and the coming to a new land. So it was more character driven than about the ocean, even though they did take a journey on the ocean. The film itself didn't spend too much time focused on the ocean. I would say that they do all have some kind of similar inspiration to me. Whether I'm writing music for a movie or an IMAX or a concert piece, if I have visuals, and I would consider myself a visual person because I tend to get inspired by visuals and stories and emotional feelings and living life and the feelings of things that happen in the world today and the things that have happened in the past. And all of these stories, these human conditions find their way in. That's what really drives me. And whether I'm doing a movie or a concert piece, I'm driven by the same sort of thing. So I don't become a different composer entirely. You know, when I shift from one medium to another, it's still the same composer. It's just that the form is different and the how far I can develop it is different and structures are different. Because in films you're very locked into their structure and to specific timings that you're going after for the film. But in concert music you're free to create your own structures. And musical language could be more expansive as well because you're working by yourself. But it's still me doing me. So I don't feel that I become a different composer when I shift from medium to medium.
Well, I think of things like Richard Strauss's tone poems, for example. When I think of your tone poem for the Tempest, certainly that music I don't think could be written. It couldn't have been written, and it couldn't be, it would not be the same if it weren't for the inspiration behind it. And yet, to some degree, I think some people look at Richard Strauss's tone poems and say, well, they're not as musically pure as something that didn't require a program. I don't mean that as a derogatory thing, but even just right. I was thinking today, just today, in the Washington Post, the principal music critic there, Anne Majette, wrote a piece that she had just now been seduced and succumbed to the music of Star Wars as being good music.
Oh boy.
Well, yeah. Well, I mentioned that, you know, it's, yeah. Of course it's funny to people like you and me that I honestly never saw these distinctions as being important or worthwhile, but I also recognize it's a major boundary for people that they think that being inspired by a story is some sort of crutch or less worthy. Or she openly admitted to the snobism that was behind all that for her, and how when she would say film music, it was pejorative, that there was something, it was less than by any estimation. And I think we're just finally getting over that. On one front, that's a problem for us, the listener. It has nothing to do with the composers. But do you ever think in that way? I mean, you say you're the same composer, but in both the case of the symphony, where you took your cue from images of nature, this thing that inspired you, to Night in the Gallery, where your point of departure are these works of fine art.
I remember going into a class when I was at USC, and I was in composition class, and I remember coming in, and I think it was a conducting class, if I could remember. It was so long ago, but I just remember bringing in Rachmaninoff's second or third piano concerto, and I also brought in a piece by Gershwin. And these were pieces I wanted to practice conducting to, but I noticed immediately that the view of these pieces was shouldn't I be picking a piece that is somehow more serious or something? Which, because perhaps maybe those were very emotional and picturesque and were describing some kind of program of some kind. And I remember how thinking how ridiculous that distinction was. For me, I'm talking for myself. I really, really thrive off of emotions. I'm an emotional being. And when I think of a feeling or a story or a visual, or in the case of Night in the Gallery, I had these beautiful paintings. I'm staring at Rembrandt's Bathsheba bathing, or Boucher's Diana bathing, or De La Tour, the cheat with the Ace of Diamonds. I'm looking at these paintings, all of which actually I believe are at the Louvre Museum, but which I was looking at from at a book called Treasures at the Louvre. And it just inspired me. I'm looking at the expressions on their faces, what they might have been thinking, the feelings. And then all of these feelings started coming over me and started to express themselves in music. So I've always been a storyteller in music. I love that sort of thing. And even when I compose concert pieces that are without a program, somehow visuals still find their way in my mind and inspire me, or a feeling of a visual or a feeling of a story. And I thrive on that.
Well, I don't think that's unusual. I mean, even in the case of Beethoven, you know, all these subtitles that his piano sonatas took on. Very often he would say to people, he'd write a new piano sonata and he'd play it, and he'd turn to a friend and say, "Can you guess what that one was about?" Perhaps with Bach, you know, the most purely musical composer in that way, and yet without a doubt he was inspired by the world around him.
It would be a challenge for me to sit down and compose something and try to make it thoroughly pure. In other words, no picture and no program to go with it at all. I mean, to sit there and empty my mind of all emotions of that of visual and write something of total purity of sound. That would be a real challenge. Maybe I'll try it someday, but I don't know how good it would be. I don't get revved up from that way of thinking. So it wouldn't get me going very far. Probably I'd probably get into the third or fourth bar, and I'd be looking up at the sky and going, look at that beautiful cloud up there. And and somehow that would find its way in. It'd be hard to be pure.
People talk about this, the people who are trained in musical notation and play an instrument. It's like, well, here's, you know, when you hold the flute like this and play an A, you get the sound, you get the physical position of your fingers, and you get the note, the line on the staff that tells you what the note is. There's a visual, there's a physical, and there's an oral idea. And I was thinking of the very first bar of your tone poem, The Tempest, which you notated when I first looked at the score. You notated it in 1/4. You said you had suffered over that to just get it exactly the way you wanted it. Is there not some sort of intellectual practice that takes place no matter what before you get those notes on paper? You're conforming it into something that's in the real world, and music itself is abstract.
Getting back to the formation, you know, or when I first started, or I was in college, and, you know, you're given assignments, composition assignments. And, you know, even there, one of my first composition assignments was to write a piece that's thoroughly linear. I hope I'm not getting too far off your last point of your question, but I'll get to that. The assignment was all linear instruments. In other words, instruments that couldn't play chords, no piano, nothing like that. Because the assignment was to stretch your ability to imply harmonic ideas and so forth within instruments that are single line instruments, so that you're creating in other words, single woodwinds or even a string quartet or something like that would be fine. So I chose to do, I think the piece had flute, oboe, clarinet, bassoon, and percussion, but the percussion did not include piano and harp. And even there, I ended up writing a piece that I called Suite for the Insects. So I kind of imagined all these different insects. The first movement was Jump of the Flea. So I imagined this flea, this flea just jumping around, and that became, and then the second movement was called March of the Ants. And so I imagined a black ant army and a red ant army, and they both ended up having to go off and into war against each other in order to get that underground space that they wanted. I guess the red ants wanted certain tunnels, and the black ants wanted those same tunnels. And so they went to war, and then it ended up in a big, horrible mess. And then the third movement was Bloom of the Butterfly, and the fourth was all the insects end up getting together and having one big waltz at the end where they all end up in like a big ballroom together and they have a huge party. Well, he's fluttering around, you know. I was just thinking, you know, that even then in college, when I was supposed to write this pure piece, linear music, I end up creating a story about insects and doing it that way. So I managed to find a way out of all of those assignments by creating a visual. And as far as the things like preparing my mind or preparing how to take on the opening bar, for example, of The Tempest, that opening 1/4 measure that you just brought up, I spent more time on that 1/4, that one beat, than you could believe trying to orchestrate it to get the effect of a sudden storm at sea. Where the orchestra had to just sort of dig in so hard and so aggressively into that bar, and to do it so it didn't sound clumsy. You know, it would be so easy if it wasn't orchestrated or balanced quite right. You know, any number of instruments could have ended up overtaking it and ruining the whole effect. That's how it sounds on the piano, but of course it was the whole orchestra had to rush down that opening chord. The Tempest starts out with the sudden storm of sea, and I wanted to just go at it literally and attack it where it comes out of nowhere. But then all of a sudden it rests and all the waves are moving throughout, and there's this huge storm that just sort of starts to settle around, and movement of currents are just sort of that are overpowering, that we, you know, that we can't even begin to fathom, because there's such weight in the ocean. And I wanted to create that, but then lift it into the opening theme. And lift out of the storm and into melody and into something of the characters that we're going to come to know as the piece goes on.
The Tempest is in my opinion, a highly, highly underrated piece. It's sort of buried on what, track 18 or something on a Shakespeare compilation that you conducted for Vrez Sarabande. But it was just something that was sort of at the end, and I didn't discover it for years and years, but it's a sort of major 16 or 17 minute concert work. I chalked this up, as you know, to this sort of deprogramming and bias that still exists today in the orchestra world, that these things aren't totally embraced. What To what degree are you optimistic that things will change and these pieces like The Tempest or The Symphony or Night in the Gallery will eventually find a place in the repertoire? And to what degree do you care in terms of how, getting them together and composing them?
I would be lying if I didn't admit that I do care. Of course, anytime you put a lot of effort into something, you know, you want to see it have a life and find its way. I composed that piece back in 1997, and it still has never had a premiere. So you can see that it's been a long time and still no premiere in sight. It is the last piece on the compilation, although I must say there's something to be said for it being the finale. I don't know if that's a bad or good thing. At the time, I thought, wow, I'm the finale. You know, I didn't think of it in terms of I'm the last piece on the on the piece. But, you know, it was a beautiful offering that Bob Townsend at Berez offered to me to write a concert piece based on any Shakespearean play that I wanted to do. And I chose that one. And, you know, we had the Royal Scottish National Orchestra record it. And I had some fantastic playing with probably one of the best brass sections in the world. And that piece really needed a great brass section. It needed really great French horns. And we had it in droves. I feel really lucky to just have that recording. Having said that, I really do want to perform it someday. And
you go to concerts. I mean, what's your sort of frank assessment of the concert world today? You and I just saw each other in Los Angeles. Every time I go to Los Angeles, I try to assure you that it's better in Los Angeles in terms of new music than any other place in the country, perhaps in the world. I mean, here in Boston, I think they just discovered Bartok and Stravinsky. I mean, they're only up to 1944. Forget about 1997. But with that said, if I have an issue with Los Angeles, it's that there seems to be a very thick line that they have drawn in the orchestra world that in Los Angeles, the film industry is commerce, and that's it has no place. Or if it does get performed by the orchestra, it's in a sort of it's cordoned off as this sort of big spectacle at the Bowl or something. It's all your music. And if an orchestra were to play The Tempest as part of a concert in a 15-minute slot, they could very easily just as well perform a 15-minute suite from Star Trek VI. There's this clear prejudice against this music. But let me put it this way. Let me flip it around. I was talking to a film composer, or rather a composer who has done many films, about Thomas Addis, has just this year scored, I believe it's his first film, for Colette. And I was really looking forward to hearing what he did, knowing so much of his other music, his concert music, which is by and large in the language of concert music in the year 2018, 2019, what have you. And then I went, and what he did for that film, I don't know if you saw it, was it's a very traditional tonal film score, which works. And there are these little waltzes and little delightful pieces. And I just couldn't square that in my own mind. It was sort of reverse prejudice where I say, what is he doing? Where is Thomas Addis? You know, the Thomas Addis that we all know and love. To some degree, it's the same with when you go to hear Ennio Morricone's concert pieces, you know, the composer of The Mission and The Untouchables and all that. The guy could write the most beautiful melody in his sleep. And yet when you hear his concert work, it's in, for lack of a better term, mid or late 20th century concert hall vernacular. It's not at all the music that you'd recognize from his film. And so I've never reconciled any of this, the prejudice on the sides of the orchestras that they without question have not embraced the most popular composers of our time, including John Williams. Not very, very many of these orchestras are playing his violin concertos or cello concerto or oboe concerto. And that's one thing. But then on the flip side, they don't at all acknowledge, by and large, probably without a doubt, the cultural legacy of California is the film industry. That's America's greatest export in terms of cultural influence in the world. And film music is a huge part of that. Do you have any of your own frustrations or thoughts or insight?
Two thoughts I have about it. One is just one thought in relation to the Thomas Otis score for Colette. I watched the movie, and you know, I think that for him, he probably just watched the movie and quite simply thought, this is the kind of music I think makes the movie work best. And I think he shifted into a place where he was serving the film, and maybe serving the film was not doing what he normally does in his concert music world. And that may have very well been in his mindset, serve the movie and write a score that makes the movie work as best as possible. I think that's a likely scenario. The other thing is when you're working within the film world, you know, you have a director and producers and you know, it has to appeal on a wide level. And so it needs to be accessible as well. So it, all of that probably played into it. But I would say, as far as the prejudice that you were talking about, I mean, I submitted my symphony for orchestra and two pianos years ago to the LA Philharmonic, and I did get some reaction, but of course it still hasn't been accepted as something to be programmed yet. You know, I thought to myself, shouldn't they? Here I am, an LA composer. I've lived here my whole life. I've been going to see the LA film my whole life and so forth. And now here I write, I'm a local guy who comes out of film music, but here I write a symphony. Wouldn't a local orchestra like the LA Phil want to do it? And that would be my hope. I don't want to get discouraged yet because I still feel that it's early in the piece's life. It just got released for the first time in November. It's very possible that at some point, that'll happen.
The Washington Post just discovered Star Wars.
So well, to be honest with you, I'm not all that intensely hopeful about it, but I don't want to shut that door in my mind because if it were to happen, it would be an absolute blast. I got a call the day after Symphony for Orchestra and Two Pianos was released by the artistic director of the Prague Festival. His name is Nikola Boysev. And I thought to myself, wow, already how wonderful it is to get the music out there and get a call. So that was quite a pleasant surprise. Having done both concert pieces and film scores, you know, they both do march differently. You know, I work just as hard as on a film score as I work on a concert piece. So it's not like I take it easy on one and work hard on another. It's like, it's all the same hard effort. I think that the difference is with film scores in a lot of ways, and it could be that some prejudice could be coming from this point of view, you know, In my symphony, there's three movements, and each movement runs between, let's say, 9 and 14 minutes long. And there's this development that takes place where compositionally, the piece has to stand on its own two legs completely, and it has to develop on its own terms. And it has to stand on its own without any visual aid whatsoever. So there's a certain amount of expectation put on a concert piece that has to have all of that backbone to it or that structure. And in the case of me, I probably fall into some strange crack because here I am writing a concert piece with the going on an adventure basically to accomplish that kind of concert music development, but yet there's this programmatic feeling in it, and I always tend to go for melody. I feel like, you know, what's wrong with giving a concert music crowd a melody to grab onto and be able to actually hum when they walk out? Why does concert music have to leave you with this feeling like you can't remember any of it, but you remember the effect of it? And I find when I go see a lot of contemporary concerts is that when I walk out, I more or less remember the feeling of it and the textures of it and the general mood, but I can never recall the melodies, if there ever was one. Sometimes they don't have any, or sometimes they're so abstract that you can't really make them out, or maybe they're very, very complex and very rhythmically challenging and discordant in terms of the intervals between the notes that are so sort of hard to grab onto that it's hard for anybody to walk out and remember that melody.
And well, let me say that. I mean, from that Washington Post piece, the writer says, "While I liked John Williams' music just fine when I first saw Star Wars at age 12, by the time I had gained adulthood, laden with the cargo of acquired snobbery about the superiority of Western civilization, I had learned and bravely parroted that film music was somehow beneath me. And for the next 3 decades, through all the sequels that I didn't see, the quartet that Williams composed for the inauguration of Barack Obama, which I did, I continued to use that film music as a pejorative term. If looked closely, probably meant to me something akin to something which one enjoys but shouldn't." And she finishes by saying, "Good means good. Effective means effective. Given that I've always made a point of embracing the best of popular fiction from Stephen King to John le Carré, why I was so close to the best of popular music, including a score that always had me and everyone else humming along." John Adams talks about these things in terms of the pleasure principle had been rediscovered when he discovered minimalism, that there's nothing wrong with trying to write a piece of music that people liked. But that of course was the thing. I mean, that old adage of in 20th century music where people would be walking out of the concert hall going, "Well, that was a lot better than it sounded." To be blunt about it, I think if your symphony were to be played in Los Angeles, people would love it.
Thank you for that. I feel, and I've always felt that, you know, you want to reach people. And I think that one of the strengths of film music very often is the melodic ideas, is the emotional feelings that people love on a mass scale out there. People love hearing that, the beauty of it. In the case of the concert music world, I think one of the challenges I think for film composers is if they want a film score to be set up onto a concert stage, you know, like we talk about, you know, can you put a film score on the same program with a Beethoven symphony? Well, you can, but you have to treat the film score it's more of theme and variations in many ways. It's kind of doing several themes and variations, but it's not drawn out. It's not under the same development structurally as a grand Beethoven symphony. Now, in the case of concert music done by film composers, I mean that, or in the case of doing a film score in concert, I think that the great thing that a composer could do is take that work and actually really turn it into a good concert piece. Take the ideas from it, but don't just cut and paste them together and say, here, they're this cue are all cut together and now it's all one concert piece, because in a way it'll sound like that. It'll sound sort of piecemeal together, and you get a melody and the melody stops and you get another melody and that one ends.
Well, it's one of my frustrations. I mean, why do you think that so many composers for film rarely take the time to do that? I find, you know, I'm here in Boston where John Williams would come every year and bring
his latest piece, and he would joke about it that above the proscenium at Symphony Hall in Boston, there's just one name, and it says Beethoven. And he said, you know, when that's there staring at you, you think twice about what works on the concert stage and what doesn't. Yeah. And he had years to sort of try things out and to get the materials cleaned up, and you know, some stuff made the cut and some stuff quickly fell out of his own repertoire, but he was responsible for publishing it. It's a great frustration to me that more film composers don't take personal responsibility for their music in that way.
Well, it's time. Number one, it's time consuming. And number two, a lot of the very well-known film composers work 2, 3, 4 movies a year. And some of them probably don't have the time. And then the other thing is you have to really be interested in doing that. A lot of interest comes, you know, when there's a certain amount of encouragement to do it.
I heard you recently on that podcast when you were reminiscing about Jerry Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. To me, Jerry Goldsmith was one of our great composers, period.
Yes.
And I'm talking about, you know, John Williams will say this about Jerry Goldsmith or Alex North or David Raxon in his mind, that these were super talented people who just lent their talent to film. They could have endeavored, I think in the case of Goldsmith, it's clear that he could have done anything. Right. He was that type of composer, and film gave him what he needed, what he wanted. But with that said, he didn't concertize and do as many concerts as John Williams. He cleaned up some of his stuff, but even today, it's just a practical concern. People don't know where to find the music or what. And, you know, there's, especially in his catalog, there's a lot of really, really bad films with really, really good music that have sort of fallen out of favor. But James Horner is another example that now that he's no longer with us, I a handful of published concert suites, but nobody knows where to find them. And that, I have to tell you, on the practical side, is a real barrier for orchestras, that they don't know where to get this stuff. Even if they were aware of the music and even if they wanted to program it, they're not going to go out of their way to say. And if you look at a case of a score like Chinatown, it's got 4 pianos. You know, no orchestra in the world is going to hire 4 pianos to do a concert suite. And it goes back to this thing. When you write music, like when you write something like Night in the Gallery, are you weighing practical concerns, knowing that you're hoping that these things are ultimately performed versus something that you would do in film?
Because they're really, really, they are focused and tailored for concert performances. So I have all the parts ready. I have, you know, my website with a contact. If you want to perform it, here's where you know, all you have to do is give me this information. And it's, I'm trying to make it easier if a conductor finds it that they want to do it. Same thing with The Tempest and my Symphony for Orchestra and Two Pianos and some other concert pieces that I'm developing. I have a few of my film scores that are, I've really turned into concert pieces. One of which is Triumph of the Spirit, which has been performed by the Los Angeles Master Chorale in concert a few times, as well as the Los Angeles Jewish Symphony under Noreen Green, and also the Fairfax Choral Society, which I was lucky enough to conduct it there in near DC, and other performances. And so I have the parts, I've got the score, it's sort of, but you have to kind of, I think in a way as a composer, unless you hire a publishing company to do that, you sort of just need to kind of have it yourself. And if you don't have the time, get an assistant to kind of send the parts out and all of that. I mean, obviously, you know, you work with Philip Glass, and I'm sure you're far more of an expert on that than I could ever even dream to be on how to do that, because he's so sought after and he has so many performances worldwide, all year long. You know, I need to learn from you on that one.
I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, we were sitting down to a company meeting where it was his booking agent, his publishing company, his record company. It was, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 people around a table. And we're sitting down and Philip says, you know, people think, I think I was the only person to catch this, but he said people think being a successful artist has something to do with talent or determination. It has to do with organization. That, like I say, I mean, the 9 to 5 of being an artist, so many artists that I know say, well, you know, I I write music for free. It's just all this other stuff, which is work that I have to do, that they don't really, you know. And I think I see that a lot in Philip, that for him, the work is not writing the music. The work is getting on planes.
Yeah.
And hustling meetings all the time. And there's so many artists that either don't have the tools, they don't want to do that, they have no interest, they don't understand how it works. And there's a lot to do. A lot of that has to do with that, cultivating relationships, you know, much like in film, where a composer would be lucky to have one director, you know, Rota had Fellini, Williams has Spielberg, Silvestri has Zemeckis, Elfman has Burton. If you have one director, you're already luckier than most composers.
True, particularly if they're a successful director, because that could keep one composer busy every year.
Well, I can tell you, it's very much the same thing in the concert world. There are a great number of composers who have one conductor who champions their work. In the case of Philip Glass's symphonies, 10 of the now extant 12 symphonies that he's written were commissioned by one conductor who, by and large, has been mostly the only champion of the symphonies. There's been very few exceptions. A couple of them have caught on, and, you know, ultimately that's almost say that's successful. If you get 50 performances of a piece of music, then, you know, in that world, that's successful. It's nothing compared to how many people hear a big film score for a successful movie. But no, I don't think that has the thing that really has never made any sense to me, because I discovered Danny Elfman's score for Batman when I was 10 years old, the same year I discovered Beethoven. And I've been trying to reconcile the issue of quality in my mind, programmatic versus pure, or music which is hastily written versus music that takes years, you know, painstakingly poring over every note. And I've learned all sorts of things, like having more time is no indicator of quality.
Right,
you know,
right.
Some of the best things ever written were written in, you know, in a fortnight.
Yeah.
It's not that. It's something totally different. And for me, what I've learned, being an active participant in concert production and developing these relationships with orchestras, is that the quality thing is not as big a consideration as you would think. I mean, you would roll your eyes if you knew how a lot of orchestras do their programming. It has to do with, they have a commitment to a conductor, and the conductor says, oh, I want to do an all Beethoven program. And then they say, well, we have a commitment to this violinist that we have to do a concerto, and she's not offering the Beethoven violin concerto. And so then they go back to the conductor and say, you know, an all Beethoven program's out because she's offering, you know, Bartok's first violin concerto and Mozart's third violin concerto. And then they go back, you know, it's just this back and forth of commitments and balancing things. And that's why it all ends up a hodgepodge. There's very little idealism in it. And there's very little, in this article in the Washington Post, they talked about orchestras and their management being gate holders, you know, gatekeepers for arbiters of taste. It really has nothing to do with that. And so when things like you writing a symphony happen, I'm mostly concerned with that. I'm mostly concerned with the piece gets written, and then things will eventually resolve if you give a chance to enough people to discover it. And that's why I'm so excited about these recordings. Can you tell me one thing about what it was like to record at Abbey Road? Had you recorded there before?
Never. And it was really, really interesting, because in one hand, when I did the symphony, you know, I had to do it very quickly. It was on a shoestring budget. So if I had rehearsals and I had all the things that go along with usually recording a symphony, which is, you know, rehearsals, and then they do a concert, and then they record it. So it's all worked out. For me, it was like I had to do all that working out prior to the session. So when I came in, I had to just pre-interpret everything so that the symphony can get recorded in the amount of time I had to do it. It went down, and and with the large forces in the symphony, it was very interesting in that room. It was very, it's a very live, and you get a very large, a lot of air around the orchestra, and it's, so it's a sort of this beautiful, airy sound. And when it comes to the night in the gallery, which is only 23 players or 24 players, it's a more of a chamber orchestra piece. Every single instrument at Abbey Road Studio One, which is a large, larger room, it just speaks clearly. You hear every detail, particularly in a chamber-like setting. And I was so happy. Every passing bar, I was like, wow, I hear it all. It's all there. Also, some of my favorite bands recorded there. I mean, we're talking about the Beatles and Pink Floyd and others. This is sort of this legendary place to just walk in there. You could just, you can smell the history when you walk through those doors, and you come in there and you suddenly feel like you're sort of a part of it now. And to do this with nothing less than the LSO was sort of the perfect combination, you know. And then I had Michael McHale and Tom Poster, two fantastic concert pianists who joined forces together and joined the LSO to do the Symphony for Orchestra and two pianos. I look back on it with such a feeling of, I must do it again. You know, I really have that feeling. I must do it again. I mean, that's what, for me as a composer, that's what I strive for. That's what life is about for me on a musical level, is to compose pieces, try to challenge myself, and ultimately record it. Because, you know, if I don't get it recorded, it's just sitting on paper. You know, so it's got to be recorded and made available for people to hear. And luckily that's just happened. So I'm going to remain optimistic that conductors and orchestras will, if they don't discover it now, maybe they'll discover some of my concert music at some point in the future. But hopefully it will reach people. And even if it doesn't, I mean, the fact that it's out on a recording means people can listen to it. It is available to hear, and that was important to me.
Well, and you do have a performance of the symphony scheduled.
Funny enough, it's a film music festival, but they have started this year adding a concert where it's film composers who do concert pieces. And I thought, what a perfect concert to be asked to do. Because I do film music and I do concert pieces. And it's like somehow this festival and this orchestra and this person recognize that we do this other work, and that maybe this is the first of many concerts like it. Maybe they recognize the gap that we were talking about earlier of the concert, you know, of the traditional orchestra environment, and organizations that have not recognized film composers who do concert music.
For ages, orchestras did not play ballet music. And imagine what we would be losing if we just considered Stravinsky a ballet composer.
Right.
Well, this part, and this could be the end part, and I'm totally ripping this off from that great British BBC program called Desert Island Discs. I'm just going to ask you to give me a favorite book, a favorite piece of music, and a favorite movie.
Give me a moment here.
Well, I mean, Desert Island Discs, they had people like Miklos Rocha, and they've had people like Brian Eno and all these people, and they pick fascinating things, because sometimes the answers are very field.
Let me start with my favorite book. Andre Previn wrote a book called No Minor Chords. I have to say, to this day, it's my favorite book, probably because I relate to it so much. You know, he was a composer who was working in the 40s and 50s, I guess, and 60s, maybe not the 40s, 50s, 60s, during the MGM days. And he wrote about his experience working as a composer and arranger, and all of the stories that went along with that. I really enjoyed that book.
Of course, the reason why they call it No Minor Chords is they were screening a film for one of the studio heads, and with the music, and the studio head screamed, "What is that?" And they said, "Oh, that's a minor chord, sir." And he said, I hate it. Get rid of it."
He said, "No, yeah, I hate it. Get rid of it." And then there was a sign that went up in the music department that said no minor chords. So I guess composers, if they wanted to keep their jobs, had to keep playing in major keys.
Oh my God.
I don't know how they managed that one, but
all right. Music.
Favorite music, I would have to say, maybe a cliche of some kind, but I would often have to just keep coming back to this, and it would have to be Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. I mean, the piece is so complete, and it's so joyous, and it's so profound, and so developed, and powerful, and it just has one of the greatest gifts that man ever got. It's almost like it's such a spiritual book. It's like this, it's like a guide to how to, it's like a guide to the greatest parts of what it's like to live life.
Do you remember Wheel of Fortune, back when they had to turn the letters around on a pole? Somebody had done the math that the most common consonants and vowels were RSTLNE. And it was really boring, because at the end of every show, they would say, you know, four consonants and a vowel, and everyone, every single show, would say RSTLNE. Now, as a default, they give them RSTLNE. I'll give you Beethoven's Ninth, but how about besides Beethoven's Ninth?
Okay. All right, I'll give you one.
I'll tell you this. Rocha was on the show, and he picked Beethoven's Ninth, so you have to pick something else.
Beethoven's Fifth. Let me pick something else for you. Mahler 2, 5, 6. Yeah. And three. The last movement of Mahler's Third.
Thank you for this, because this is teaching me a lesson very quickly. I'm never going to ask this again. What I'm going to ask instead is, what is your favorite film score?
Oh, okay. My favorite film score. Wow. That's a tough one. Possibly Star Wars. Isn't that funny that we mentioned it earlier? I mean, there are other ones, of course.
Well, that's okay. But I can't imagine Star Wars is your favorite movie. So what would your favorite movie be?
Well, you know, the first movie that actually did pop into my mind, and I'll explain why, is The Sound of Music. That movie, the combination of what they've created in that movie of the Christopher Plummer character in contrast to the Maria character, Captain Von Trapp versus Maria, the whole backdrop of the Nazis coming in and basically taking over Austria, and this man standing firm on his principles, and music being a place where they were able to escape into in order to have this maintain some sense of beauty in their life among this darkness that was just coming at them. I just thought it was beautifully done. Really an unusually great movie, and put together so beautifully. And every performance is a standout. And that's a movie I've seen a number of times and never get tired of it. Anyways, there's another. I have to say, I thought Amadeus was a tremendous film. You know, the performance of F. Murray Abraham, Salieri, and it was so extraordinary. And the Mozart performance, you know, that performance was really extraordinary, because what he brought out in Tom Hulse, the performance he gave to Mozart, I thought was so astounding, because he managed to bring out both the depth of the man, the genius of the man, but also the immaturity of him, all wrapped up into one character. And I thought that was, and of course, you know, I thought it was beautifully shot, and the way that they pieced the music together, it was fantastic.
Well, you're a composer. I mean, can you imagine that you're now 20 years older than Mozart was when he died?
Yeah. I mean, and when I listen to what he did in his Requiem, for example, every passing bar is just, to me, somewhat of a miracle. It also just the concept that he would be so smart, so intelligent, as to be able to compose the way that he did. I don't know if it's true that he would actually composing it as at you know, sick in bed, and being able to just sort of say to an interpreter, you know, say to somebody what to write down, and be that brilliant. I don't know if that's just for a movie effect, or if that actually, if something like that might, but I wouldn't doubt that he could have easily done something like that.
Not to put you in Salieri's shoes, but is there anyone alive, or anyone that has been alive in your lifetime, a composer that you were just in awe of their ability?
Yes, I really am in awe of a composition teacher that I had at USC, who's become quite the choral composer of the world, Morten Lorentzen. I'm never starstruck. I really am not. I could be standing next to the biggest movie star of all time, or the biggest rock star of all time, and I don't get that feeling in me of that I get when I went to see this concert one time, and here my teacher walks in. We were listening to, I think it was a concert of Lux Aeterna, and I saw him there, and I stood and looked at him, and I was a little bit starstruck, because I, and in some ways, I felt like I was looking at a modern day Brahms or someone of that stature. Here he was standing before me. So isn't that wonderful to have a teacher that you feel? I look back now, and I think to myself, wow, the one person that I have that kind of feeling towards was my teacher at school.
Yeah.
You know.
No, I think that's normal. I mean, we forget that, you know, we've invented the sort of great man theory of history, right? Talk about Mozart, he was very fallible. But even Beethoven had already begun his career. He had already begun writing symphonies, and he continued studying with a guy named Albrechtsberger, because there was all sorts of things about counterpoint that he still didn't feel he had mastered, that he wanted to know. And it's, we accept these things in the schools of painting, where you say, oh, okay, well, the guy who knew how to do these techniques knew how to do these techniques, but he was not a great artist. It, you know, very rarely does it work out in the case of somebody like Lorentzen, where you can look at him and say, he's contributed a handful of the greatest choral pieces the last 50 years.
Yeah.
And there he is. I know him. He's there right in front of me, and he's human, like you and me.
I'll tell you one quick little story about that really brought tears to my eyes. A few weeks ago, it was the winter concert at Santa Monica High School, where my daughter goes, and it's one of the very, very great high school choral groups in the country. Anyways, I go to this concert, and I see my daughter, who's 15 years old, singing this piece by Morten Lorentzen that is, you know, just one of those drop-dead, beautiful, emotional pieces of music. And I'm looking at her singing it, and all of a sudden I have this flashback of a time way before she was born, me sitting in his class, and I remember him sitting at the piano and playing some chords, trying out chords for us and saying, what do you think of this move here? And he was playing this chord that had a little tension and then would resolve. But the contrast of looking back and remembering this guy, what he's working on, and asking me what I think, to all of a sudden being sitting there in this auditorium all these years later and seeing my own daughter singing it, just floored me. It really did. It brought tears to my eyes.
It's great to be alive.
That's what it felt like. I felt like it was this moment that made me feel like, looking back, it's like, oh, wow, I have had a life. You know, I've had this life where I've been around long enough at this point where I could look back and see those experiences back to back and appreciate them. And I, oh, man, that feeling, I'm telling you, Richard, that was such a great moment in my life. And of course, after the concert, I went up to my daughter and I said, I have to tell your choir director about that story. And she forbid me to tell him that story. She it would have embarrassed her.
Well, I have to say, I don't know how many years ago you and I first made contact, but we immediately started talking about your music, and you mentioned to me that someday you hoped to write a symphony. And then maybe 3 years later, you called me up and you said, I did it. Now what? And to me, you talk about these things coming full circle. To me, it's crystal clear that the most important thing is getting these pieces written, because people make a big mistake in looking back at artists' lives and saying, oh, well, Verdi wrote whatever it is, 20, 25 operas, but he didn't write any symphonies. He wrote one string quartet. It's like, well, he very much saw himself as an opera composer and nothing more. You know, concert music was a Germanic pursuit. I'm not saying it would have been, who knows what it would it have been if somebody had asked Verdi to write a symphony, or at the end of his career, Wagner wanted to write symphonies. And he never got around to it, because he viewed Beethoven as the sort of epitome of all human musical accomplishment.
Trying to figure it out, figuring out the concert music world, the way orchestras work, how they choose pieces, how they don't choose pieces, how you get it performed versus not get it performed, the attitudes toward film composers versus the attitudes with or against them, or whatever it is. It's almost like, at some point, in order to create music, you just have to kind of put that on a shelf somewhere, all of it, and say, okay, now I'm going to sit down and I'm just going to do what I do, which is compose music. And however that comes out, that's going to come out, and not worry, overly worry, I should say, because the worry will be there about how this will get performed. Not overly worry about it, because otherwise that sort of can take you over and take the spirituality of the pursuit away, and the beauty of the pursuit gets dampened down by too much thinking. I think that, not to be naive or idealistic, but in some ways you kind of have to shut it all down and just close the door and turn off the cell phones and spend some time and just dig into music. And that's what's driven me. But I must say, on another statement, I don't know if I would have written the symphony had we not had all those early discussions about why doing it and should I do. I don't know if I would have. I might have. I know it's always been in my mind to do it, but I must say that my relationship with you has been one that has taught me a lot about the. You're kind of a bridge between the two worlds, concert music and film music, and you, because you have a love of both. And so you're kind of that perfect hybrid of knowing the value of both and bridging them and trying to knock that barrier down. And I think that's one of your missions.
I'll thank you for taking the time. And I'll remind people that the Symphony for Orchestra and Two Pianos was released on November 2nd, digitally. Night in the Gallery was just released on the 11th of January. And the CD, it has a worldwide release on February 1st, 2019. And I'm personally so excited and happy that you did these things, because they're beautiful. And I hope you do a lot more.
Thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate it.